Welcome to Flower Friends. This is your host, Sarah Nayani, and this is the second episode of the Flower Friends podcast. If you didn't listen already, you might want to jump back to episode number one. I released it on Saturday, and it's just a little bit of an intro to me, my little cute little flower business in Seattle, and some of the things that I'm hoping to accomplish through this podcast. So on today's episode, we are talking to Hillary Dahl from Seattle Urban Farm Co. We had such a fun conversation. We talked for so long that I'm going to keep this intro pretty short today, but I want to start each episode with just a little bit of an update of what's going on with Grow Girl Seattle, which is my business here in Seattle. So this week was the last week in March, and so I finished my March flower subscriptions. It was a 5-week subscription where each week my customers get a delivery to their home in the Seattle area. And I have gotten to the point in the season where I'm able to use mostly my own flowers. At the beginning of March, I didn't have a lot in bloom, so I was buying in from Seattle Wholesale Growers Market some gorgeous flowers, but it's just really exciting to be to the point where more of my own garden flowers are growing and bulbs are coming up. So right now we have tulips in bloom, daffodils in bloom, and if you stay till the end of the episode, I have some tips on arranging and designing with daffodils because they're a little bit tricky to mix with other flowers. And so I had something that just bloomed a couple days ago. It was a crown imperial fritillaria. It was like bright orange. It's this beautiful thing, and it really does look like a crown. It's just got this huge stalk and then this sort of like set of flowers kind of hanging down, and on top of that it's sort of like a green plume. It reminds me a little bit, it looks like a bird or something tropical. And so it's really cool that it will grow here in Seattle. And this is quickly becoming one of my favorite flowers to arrange with, but I only bought 4 bulbs back in the fall and planted them. So for next year, I just ordered a bunch more because I can't get enough. They're pretty pricey, but if you're a home gardener or you're thinking about using them for cut flowers, in my opinion, completely worth it. So yeah, that's kind of where we're at. I'm about to start my April flower subscription this week. And so basically what I do is on Mondays, I'll start the harvesting or shopping if I need to get any additional items. And then I deliver on Tuesdays or Wednesdays, depending on the neighborhoods that people live in. So getting geared up for that. I also just did something that I was a little nervous to do, and I sent out a survey to my March subscribers to get some info on what they thought about color palette, delivery options, and subscription options. And so I just wanted to share a little bit about that in case any of you have a flower business. But people seem to like, you know, just sort of a random color palette of me just choosing the best flowers, not based on color. And so I thought that was kind of cool because I was nervous that people would want to pick their own palette for the entire month. Like maybe they only want soft colors or they only want bright colors. And so it works out much better to be able to pick what's in season, what I have blooming, and what's available at the wholesale market in the palettes that I love, and also the flowers that are looking the healthiest and freshest, so hopefully people can get a longer vase life. So that was some cool feedback. And then another thing that I got feedback on was that people wanted longer term subscriptions than just 1 month. And I've been doing 1 month subscriptions just so that I can kind of plan my life. I can't plan my life like 8 months in advance. And so I haven't been able to figure out how to do a longer term season subscription. And I guess I always assumed that customers would just want like very set dates. And so I've always been nervous about like saying, oh, we'll start the subscription when my flowers start blooming, because people might be traveling or going out of town and I don't want them to miss the weeks that they've signed up for. So right now I'm just doing monthly, but based on my feedback, I think I need to figure out how to do a longer subscription. So if any of you out there have suggestions, I would love to hear them. So just getting into like a lot of seed sowing right now. I started my seed sowing back in January, but we'll be continuing doing that until, you know, probably about, I guess, maybe June. And then we'll start again in July for things that I'm going to plant that are cold hardy. I'll plant those in the fall. So right now, everything I'm doing is seeds for this spring and this summer. But upcoming in the summer, I'll start some seeds for fall. And the cool part, I hope, if you're a flower grower, if you listen along to this, I'll try to just give updates of what's going on in my garden and with the flowers that I'm selling, in case that's useful to any of you, or like a good reminder of like, oh, I need to start this soon, or I want to start this soon. So anyway, that's my update for the week. And now we can roll into the interview with Hillary. We cover a lot on growing wooden raised garden beds, and we touch on a bunch of other topics, including some of the flowers that she loves, edible flowers, and just some cool ideas that she had. So I hope you'll listen in and enjoy the interview. Today, I'm so excited to welcome Hillary Dahl from Seattle Urban Farm Co. to the podcast. Welcome, Hillary.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah. Well, can you tell us a little bit about Seattle Urban Farm Co.?
Yeah. So at Seattle Urban Farm Company, we were just a design, build, and maintenance firm. And then, and we were always focused on edible gardening. So basically, we just help people create, you know, build, design edible gardens in their homes, on rooftops. Really, we've worked with clients on a variety of scales over the years, everything from like two raised beds in someone's front yard to multi-acre farms for restaurants and things like that. So we help people create, we help people grow food, basically. We help people create growing spaces. And then we have a team of people that actually go in and maintain a lot of the gardens. And each year we maintain about, I'd say around 70 gardens. And as Seattle is changing and growing, a lot of those gardens are now multifamily, like rooftop spaces or gardens at corporate sites. So there's been this kind of movement of corporations to start to use some of their unused space, whether it's rooftop or just campus, you know, in-ground campus space to grow food and then donate that food to local food banks or different nonprofits. And so that's been a really fun kind of different group of people to start to work with. But traditionally, we design, build, and maintain gardens in, you know, people's homes and residential sites, and then for restaurants and now corporate clients. So that's kind of how we started. That's our thing. And then we've done this for so long. We started in 2007. And so we've been working in all these different sites throughout the Seattle region for so long that we've really developed all of these skills and techniques and ways to maintain spaces in a really efficient and productive way, and build gardens in a really efficient and productive way. And so starting in 2012, we started creating more educational content to share those kind of pro tips with people, just with more people, because we can only work with so many people here in the Seattle area. So we've written a couple books, and I have a podcast. It's kind of touch and go right now just because of life, but we're sort of working or branching out into more and more educational kind of spheres as the business matures. Yeah, I guess that's kind of a super long-winded explanation, but.
No, it's because you guys do a lot.
We do a lot.
And you bring a lot of growers in as well, because I'm one of those. I started my husband, when I started getting more into gardening, but I was just gardening in like flower pots on my driveway. It was pretty minimal because I was traveling a lot for work. And my husband got me some of your guys' books. And so I started reading those, and then found your podcast. And so I started building some garden beds out. And so it's very addicting. And just the way that you guys break it down, and also the focus on like growing a lot in a small space and growing in an urban environment and not shying away from like growing on an impervious surface or finding ways to increase your space was really helpful to me. So
that's great. Yeah. Our goal is to kind of lower the barrier to entry to gardening, but without really like, without dumbing it down, by kind of sticking to the rules and by creating some guidelines that are easy to wrap your head around. but then give you, once you've kind of mastered those basic skills, then you can kind of go crazy and experiment more and do all sorts of things. But we've tried to simplify the growing process so that people can learn to love it and not feel like they have a black thumb. And then from there, they can get crazy and do all sorts of things. So I'm so happy to hear that that has worked for you.
Yes, definitely. And so have you always been into gardening, or when did you get started with it?
I started with Seattle Urban Farm Company in 2010, but I had always really been interested in gardening and growing food. I mean, always, maybe that's a stretch, but since my early college days. And when I was in college, I actually studied landscape architecture, and everything I did there, as much as I could, I was always trying to focus it on some sort of urban agriculture, or give all my design some sort of urban agriculture bent if I could. And so the transition to working with Seattle Urban Farm Company came pretty naturally. It was like what I wanted to do. And I just happened to reach out at the right time. And it was sort of serendipitous, because then I am now married to the, the person who started it. So that's how Colin actually met. Which was 12 years ago. It's crazy. But anyways, yeah, it's crazy.
A job and meet the man of your dreams too.
I never would have thought, but it just sort of was one of those moments that just worked out, and I don't know, it was just sort of luck. But I came into it with a passion for growing food. And then that I really honed my skills working at Seattle Urban Farm Company, because what we do is everything we do is based in farming technique. So Colin and Brad, the founders, come from farming backgrounds. So working on small farms, small like CSA type farms. And so everything we do is informed by those techniques. And I think that that's a really great way, whether you're growing food or flowers, to familiarize yourself with some of the kind of farmy growing techniques, because they're growing for production, for productivity, and to be efficient. And so if you can kind of, again, like master those skills or familiarize yourself with those techniques, then again, you can be just so much more expansive in what you do and how you manage your space, and just make it so much more productive too, because you have this great foundation.
Definitely. And I think a lot of the lessons from, your podcasts and your books are really applicable to flowers as well. I mean, a lot on soil health, and even some of the episodes on vegetables have given me ideas for either things I could grow with flowers, or things that, can grow well in a small space, or that might just be something that I want for myself. And it could be something that even improves the soil health or brings something else to the garden balance, which is really, really wonderful. So could you tell us a little bit about the books that I believe they're written by Colin and Brad, right? And then on this most recent one, you did the photography, I think.
Yeah. So I actually did the photography on the first book.
Oh, cool.
Which is Food Grown Right in Your Backyard. And that was 1 million years ago. I did photography on that. I was a little 20 something. It was a very fun project, but it was my first project like that. So I did the photography for Food Grown Right in Your Backyard. And that is our first book. And I love that book. And I am totally not being biased. I objectively love that book, because it really breaks down the garden building process. It simplifies that. But I think the real meat of the book is in how it breaks down growing different vegetables, and it gives you a little lesson for each crop. It explains how to grow each crop, and then provides a little lesson, like something that you can take away and learn from growing that crop and apply to other crops. And Florette or some amazing flower grower out there, all I've wanted is for someone to take that format, take that book and create it for growing for flowers. Wanted, when I was first learning how to grow flowers, I was like, I want this. I looked everywhere. I bought all the books, and none of them broke down flower by flower. And the thing is, once you start learning things, it's you don't really need every single flower broken down. There's sort of blanket kind of techniques or different techniques that you can apply to, a variety of things. But it just is nice, because it gives you that sense of, it gives you a little safety net, okay, I want to grow this crop or this flower. I've never grown it before. this is going to tell me exactly how to do it, and I'm going to succeed, and I'm going to learn something that I can apply to the rest of my garden. So anyways, back to Food Grown Right, that's what that does. And then it also gives you kind of overview of just like plant life 101 basics. It's very much like a basic book, and then but it's very useful. And we found that gardeners, even experienced gardeners, think it's a fantastic resource. Not to toot my own horn, but I just love that book.
No, it really is. I agree.
It's just fun. Yeah, it's a good one. And then the second one is High Yield Vegetable Gardening. And that one's actually, we replaced that book this year. So our third book, Grow More Food, replaces High Yield Vegetable Gardening. And that was one that we created kind of as like a, our publishing company had this vision for it to be kind of like a workbook. And it's also an amazing book. It's very geeky. There's lots of charts and kind of like worksheets and guides for you to figure out really how to maximize your growing space. Like if you were going to have a wedding and you wanted to grow, you know, X number of carrots for that wedding, I actually think that's an example in the book. it would like help you figure that out. You know what I mean? But so with the newest book, Grow More Food, we took that book, reorganized it, kind of updated some of the content, and then added like 250 photos. And so I basically, with the relaunch of High Yield Vegetable Gardening into Grow More Food, it was all me. I did most of the work because I took all the photos. There's a little bit of, you know, Colin and Brad definitely had to rewrite some things, but, you know, taking that number of photos is a huge job, and taking photos for a garden book, we're digressing, but it's a crazy endeavor because it's not like you can just sit in a studio and take the photos. No. It's like a year-long process because you have to get all the different phases and different processes and techniques and things like that. So anyways, again, another long-winded explanation, but we technically have two books because the second one is now out of print and we've replaced it with Grow More Food.
Oh, that's really good to know. I'm glad I got the second one before it got replaced.
Yeah, so I know. It is cool. I know. The second one is like the initial version of High Yield was really cool, I thought, but I think it just wasn't. Yeah, I think just having photos is really helpful for people. And they both have a ton of illustrations, which I also think
definitely
is cool.
Yes.
I love illustrations.
One of the things that I marked in the book is you have a page that has like a chart of flowers that attract beneficial insects. And I was wondering if you could just chat a little bit about, you know, some of the benefits that flowers might bring to a vegetable garden.
Yes, I would love to talk about that. Incorporating flowers into your vegetable garden is crucial. And it doesn't mean that you need to plant, let's say you have a couple raised beds. It doesn't mean that you need to plant your flowers, you know, directly into those beds, but having some sort of floral resource, you know, within 10, 15 feet of your garden is so beneficial because it's going to attract all of these different pollinators and then beneficial insects. You want your garden to be diverse and, you know, thriving little ecosystem. And if you don't have flowers or flowering resources, then you're not gonna attract the same diversity that you would if you have flowers. And, you know, you can, if you have a really small space, you can let things go to flower. You know, you can let arugula flower or your cilantro flower and just keep a little bit of it in your garden, and that will go a long way. But incorporating flowers in and around a vegetable garden is crucial. And if you have a garden, one of my favorite things to do is go out and just kind of like spend a moment in the garden and like what I call it having soft eyes. And you just sort of like pause and have soft eyes, if you could imagine what that would be. And you look and you would just be amazed at the variety or diversity of little insects that are everywhere in the garden. And it's not a bad thing. Certainly you want to have soft eyes to spot those insects that you don't want in the garden. But a lot of times you'd be surprised at the different types of flies and pollinators that are there that you wouldn't have noticed if you hadn't just like paused for that moment and kind of weren't really looking for anything, you know, weren't really looking for anything, just kind of observing. It's one of my favorite things to do. And I think the more I notice, the more diversity of different flies and bees and, you know, just different pollinators, wasps and things in the garden, the more I want to create an environment for all of those, you know, different pollinators and things.
I'm so glad you mentioned that, because that's one thing that really brought me to gardening is just like the peaceful moments, especially I find around maybe sunset and you've had a long day outside in the summer and maybe just take a glass of wine out and sit and just watch what's happening, because there's so much happening in the garden. And it's really cool if you change a space that might've just been rocks or gravel or pavement into something that's alive. And it's not just the big birds or the butterflies or things like that that you can see, but all the bees and the, you know, the biology that you can't see that's happening in the soil. And
yeah,
so I think that's really fascinating. I'm just like kind of a science nerd too. Yes. So that stuff just really gets me excited.
So cool. Yeah. And I guess I didn't really explain that, you know, pollinators and beneficial insects are important, or maintaining that kind of a level of, you know, your little ecosystem, that level of diversity in your little ecosystem is important because it, well, one, for a lot of, you know, fruiting crops, you need pollinators to actually pollinate unless they're self-pollinating, but a lot of them you actually need that. So if you're like, why are my winter squash, that's a big one, like why is my winter squash not fruiting? Well, you may just not have the right kind of pollinators in your garden. Or, you know, if you're having a lot of issues with bugs or aphids, aphids are obviously a type of bug, but with pests, then, you know, just having that kind of diversity of different beneficial insects and pollinators in your garden will help to just keep things a little bit more even keel and reduce the need for any sort of insecticides. Definitely, you know, you don't want to have chemicals in your vegetable garden. So they're doing some of the work for you.
I mean, I plant nasturtium sometimes like around the edges of my bed to sort of hang over. I know those are edible and I use them in salads quite a bit. And I was just wondering if there were any other flowers that are maybe edible, that if people are growing veggies and flowers and they want to pick some of the flowers to mix in, is there anything you would recommend?
Yeah, for sure. So it's funny that you mentioned nasturtium, because they're actually one of my all-time favorite flowers, but my husband has this, like Colin has this thing against them. He kind of hates nasturtiums, and it's not because I'm not trying to throw them under the bus or anything, but it's because they're always going to get aphids. Like it's inevitable.
Yeah.
You know, and then you just have, they're one of these plants that if they're in the garden, you have to keep an eye on them. And once they get aphids, and that's kind of their job. If you're planting them as a beneficial, they're attracting, they're called the trap crop. You know, you're attracting the aphids to that crop. So then you can then pull it out of the garden and remove all the aphids from your garden, but you have to be willing to do that. That's the thing about nasturtiums, but I love them. I plant them.
Didn't you guys have a like argument? I think I remember from a podcast episode where it was like, you think they basically take the aphids from other plants and he thinks they attract them to the garden.
No, I'm still on the, like, I still think they're a trap crop. So I'm still good with them as long as you're willing to pull them out. Yeah. He thinks they just attract them to the garden, and he could be right, but I'm not willing to agree to that because I love them too much. So then I would have to really think twice about planting them. But gem marigold, and I have been posting about this a lot on Instagram and things, but it's because it's kind of become our new, it's like everybody plants nasturtiums in the garden. We plant gem marigold in all of our clients' gardens.
Okay.
Because they're such a good beneficial plant. I mean, they attract, you know, tons of pollinators and beneficial insects, but then they're edible. And the smell, I'm sure it's one of those smells that you either love it or you hate it, but they have this just like really, really amazing. It's not floral. It's a bit spicy, just rich. I don't know, just really refreshing. The smell is just, I think it's amazing. And they are so low maintenance. Like you'd want to deadhead them, but there's a million flowers anyways. And so with like a more, like a larger marigold, you want to be pretty proactive about deadheading to just, you know, really encourage that flowering. But these guys, they'll just go nuts, and they're so beautiful, and they come in all sorts of colors. They're a smaller marigold than like a marigold that a lot of people would probably think of when they would think of a marigold, like a bigger one. And so they kind of have like a little bushing habit and just millions of blooms. And so it's just a really nice border plant because they add like a nice, you know, pop of color and they're edible. I've made Amaro with them.
Ooh, what's that?
Amaro is like a, I think of it as like an Italian liqueur because I think it's from Italy, but I think Amaro, the term actually means like, it's kind of like terroir or like it's a liqueur you make from whatever you have in your garden. So if you go to Italy and you try these little like digestifs, they'll be like a local version and it'll always taste a little different. So I made one out of like all the herbs and marigolds from my garden one year. And
I love that.
So yeah, and because you're supposed to use marigolds in, or most recipes call for marigolds, and these little gem marigolds were perfect.
One of the reasons I was really excited to chat with you too is there's a couple episodes on your podcast where you talk about flowers. I love that you love flowers and that you incorporate them into your veggie gardens. And I was wondering a little bit about some more of the annuals or perennial flowers that you might recommend.
Yeah. So we also always plant alyssum.
Okay.
Which is another really great low maintenance flower that you can just plant right into your veggie garden. That's the great thing about the gem marigolds and like an alyssum. You can kind of use them as a border plant. When I start to get into like the bigger beneficial pollinators, I like to actually kind of keep them in a separate space because they can get really big. Like I love cosmos. Bees and flies love cosmos because of that like ferny, lacy foliage, but they can get so big. I just don't really want them for me. I just don't really want them like in my highly productive space. I'll put them, you know, a couple feet away or in a bed that's a little bit more organic or in a bed that has bigger crops, but I don't want to plant like a bunch of cosmos next to my lettuce because it's just they're just gonna outcompete my lettuce and my lettuce is gonna be ready. So I love cosmos. I mean, the thing is I now plant all the flowers, but in our client gardens, it's pretty much alyssum, cosmos, zinnias, lots of zinnias. And we now plant quite a bit of scabiosa. It's just such an easy flower to grow. We plant snapdragons. I would say two things. Scabiosa and zinnias are both such great bumblebee habitat. That's the best way I can describe it. I don't have any scientific like research to back that up, but every time I look at a garden that has scabiosa or zinnias, there's always a bumblebee somewhere on one of the flowers. I think for the zinnias, I think that's, they catch, you know, they have these beautiful blossoms and that they kind of catch water. And so I actually think the bumblebees land there and drink water, use it like a little bird bath or something. And then the scabiosa has a million little stamen. And so I think that they go there for food, but I'm not sure. This is totally, you know, I don't know, my observations.
No, I've noticed the same thing. There's a patch in my garden last summer that has scabiosa in it. And that was like the bumblebee hive right there. They would just come in.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah. And I mean, I think the honeybees and other bees loved it too, but I especially noticed bumblebees there. And my theory would be just because the flower faces are big enough and bumblebees are a little heavier. I don't know. Maybe that's part of
it. Oh,
I
know.
Zinnias are so sturdy.
Yeah. They weigh down the other guys.
The big topic that I wanted to talk to you about today is you guys have been doing a huge series on raised garden beds, and I'm just so excited to hear a little bit more about that. So first, could you tell me a little bit about the YouTube series that you're doing?
Yes. So we just launched a 8 or 9 part, oh my gosh, it's embarrassing, 8 or 9 part YouTube series. I can't remember how many we ended up with, but on building a wood framed raised bed garden from start to finish. And so what we wanted to do was just break down the garden building process and kind of the garden quote unquote design process. We don't go into like really detailed garden design techniques and things, but we break down, you know, how you would build a simple wood-framed raised bed garden from site selection to laying out your beds to actually like installing the beds and kind of and building them, all of our pro tips. And then we want, there's two videos on drip irrigation, because hands down, like the number one question we get is, how do you install your drip irrigation systems? Can you help me install my drip irrigation system, et cetera? And instead of continuing to just like thumb type those into like Instagram replies, we decided to just go big and actually like create a step-by-step video on installing irrigation in a bed. And it's broken up in two parts, mainly because the series takes you literally from like step one, walking around your site, how would you choose a site, to filling your beds with soil and installing the irrigation. And the way we install irrigation is we install it, like we install a main line, a main header that actually brings the water from your water source to your garden. And then we pause and fill the beds with soil. And then we finish the irrigation system. So we've actually like broken down this YouTube series exactly how we would install a garden if a client like hired us to build a garden. So I hope it's useful. It's pretty geeky. We're pretty detail oriented, but we try to keep it super simple and just share all the pro tips so that people can build, you know, start off. If you're a new gardener, we really think it's super important for you to set yourself up for success. And the way to do that is by siting your garden, whether it's wood framed raised beds or just beds in the ground, by siting your garden in a good spot. And that's, you know, there's a few kind of key factors that we think like make a good spot. And then having drip irrigation. It's so crucial, I think. And not everybody needs it. But again, if you're a new gardener, just having that like a good site and drip irrigation is just going to make you're setting yourself up for success. It's going to make things so much easier because you can't make the sun shine where it doesn't already shine. And if you live in an area like we do, where it doesn't rain for 3 months in the middle of the summer, and you don't have drip irrigation, you're going to be pretty frustrated if you go out of town and come home and everything's dead. And you're going to feel like you have a black thumb.
So that like sets you up for success.
Yeah.
That way.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's just one less thing you have to think about and one less thing you have to really worry about. It doesn't mean that, you know, your garden, you do those two things and it's hands off, you know, clearly doesn't mean that, but those are things that, that are really just, you know, not stressing out your plants is just really going to make life a lot easier. And working in a place that gets plenty of sun and you're easily able to bring water to your garden, whether that's from a drip irrigation system or a hose, you know, I think it just makes things easier. So we think that's super important.
Absolutely. And I found the videos really helpful, having the visual and just seeing like the layout of how you put the wood together and how you install things is very helpful. And I think people should go find details there if they're interested, but if you don't mind just covering a few basics with us.
Oh, I would love to.
What materials do you recommend using to build beds? It sounds like wood mostly.
Yeah. So we build beds out of everything.
Okay.
But again, if we're talking about like, okay, I'm a home gardener. I'm not a professional builder. You know, this is like, I'm a weekend warrior. This is my weekend project. It might be a big lift to think about, okay, I'm going to get some steel and weld it and make these, you know, that's just adds like a whole nother layer, or I'm going to source stones and figure out how to dry stack. You know, these are skills that are much more complicated. And so we think that if you need to build, you know, beds up off of like up out of the ground, which I can talk about why you might do that in a minute, but we just think that wood is the simplest way to do it. And so we like to build them out of wood. And honestly, we build out of cedar because that's readily available here in the Pacific Northwest. We found some really great sources for it, but it's going to depend on like the wood you use is going to depend on where you are. And there are rot resistant wood. Cedar's naturally rot resistant, and there will be naturally rot resistant woods all over the country that you can source. And if those are too expensive or aren't available, pine and fir, kind of basic building lumbers, do work. And we treat all of our wood, whether it's naturally rot rot resistant. that's a tongue one. Tongue twister. Whether it's naturally rot resistant or not, with a product called Timber Pro UV, and it extends the life of the wood. So that's always going to help. It's called an internal wood stabilizer, and it just keeps water from seeping into your wood. And so it just helps, you know, extend the life of the wood. So yes, we recommend building raised beds out of wood. And, you know, some of the things we talk about in the series are, you know, choosing the size of your bed. We recommend starting with just a 4 by 8 foot raised bed. And that's because, interestingly enough, 8 foot lengths of lumber are the least expensive. They're less expensive than 6 foot.
I didn't know that.
I know. Yeah. Isn't that? Yeah. And then if you build, you know, 4 by 8, then, you know, 4 is half of 8. So you can just, you can make, it's the easiest way to build a bed with the fewest number of cuts.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
Yep. Cause it's just the slices for the sides.
Exactly. Yep. Mm-hmm. And then we sprinkle in pro tips. Like we use these corner braces that we think are super important, and cross braces, which are crucial. And I see just everywhere. There are tons of gardens out on the curb and in people's front yards in my neighborhood. And so many of them are bowing, you know, so many of the raised beds are bowing or falling apart because these teeny little details that don't add a lot of cost were overlooked, like cross bracing or the corner braces. And so we try to provide these pro tips that will just help to extend the life of your bed. Cause you know, it's an investment of time and money. And if you build a wood frame raised bed correctly, it can last, even if you're using the woods that are not naturally rot resistant, they can last 10 years or more. Some of the cedar beds can last, you know, 15. And so that's a pretty good lifespan.
Yeah, that really is. And I agree, just around the neighborhood, especially because we have so much rain in Seattle. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've seen people install like brand new beds, and then a few years later, they're just sort of, like you say, bowing out, or the joints have come apart and soil is kind of spilling out, and that's mm-hmm. not good for the plants inside. So that's another great reason to check out the videos so people can see like how you put the joints together and how you make those, build them to last, because like you say, it's not something you want to have to replace every few years, especially if you're putting time and money into building it yourself. So, and then one other thing I wanted to ask you a little bit about is I have 7 beds that are on top of our cement driveway, and I notice already, even just in the year that I've had those built, that the health of that bed isn't as good as the other beds that I have that are over soil or over grass that I've turned over, because they're getting that mixing from, but I mean, they're still able to grow things. I'm just not going to put like my dahlias or really heavy feeders into those beds that are on top of the driveway. And I was just wondering if you have any tips for people who might not have space, you know, that they can build a bed directly over lawn or over soil. Just kind of describe how you might build a bed on an impervious surface.
Yes, definitely. We do a lot of that. And, you know, I would say that building a wood framed raised bed or any framed raised bed, whether it's rock or, you know, steel or whatever concrete block that you have in your backyard, one of the reasons people do that is because the soil quality below, you know, the soil quality on their site isn't great. And that can, you know, that can, there can be a spectrum of things. It can just be that it's like rocky and you don't want to deal with it, or it can actually be contaminated. And so building up is a way to create your own little, it's a way to control your soil quality, basically. And that's one of the reasons why we like to build up. And another reason is just for aesthetics. And we're kind of all about aesthetics because we want people to think that gardening is beautiful, because it is. Yes. But so those are 2 reasons to build a raised bed. But if you're building on an impervious surface, the first thing I would say is you don't want to ever build beds. You want your build beds to be at least 16 inches tall.
Okay.
And the taller, the better. When you build a bed, like let's say you were building a raised bed and you just put it on top of sod or flipped sod or a site that had been cleared from sod, but there was soil underneath, the roots of a lot of your crops will actually reach down into that subsoil. So roots can dive deep and they can reach, and the further they can reach, the more water and nutrients they will be able to absorb. And so the better and they will do and the happier they'll be. So if you're building on an impervious surface, you want to have your beds at least 16 inches tall, and even taller is better.
Okay, great. So that gives it more soil basically to work with, more depth to grow the roots down. And then also just so there's more soil and nutrients in that bed that can sort of mix together since they're not getting anything from the ground.
Yeah. And always in every bed, I would say add organic matter, you know, composted organic matter every year. And that's because when you're working in any sort of container, and a raised bed is essentially a container, you're working in a closed system. And so there's not, you need to add nutrients basically. And, you know, you can, it, that doesn't mean that you need to go get a bunch of, you know, go spend a bunch of money or buy a bunch of chemicals or something on inputs. You can keep it pretty simple, but just adding, you know, a few inches of compost to your beds each winter or spring is a great way to add a bunch of nutrients to the soil and also protect the soil structure. And then we fertilize, and we don't use chemicals, but we use fertilizers that are all, you know, naturally derived fertilizers. But we do find that it makes a huge difference to fertilize your beds. So we broadcast fertilize, you know, all of our beds before planting, and then side dress the plants and fertilize at planting. And when you're using organic fertilizers, it's hard to overdo it. So it might sound like we're, you know, using a lot of inputs, but it's not too crazy. But we just want to be sure that we're continuing to feed the soil, because basically, sorry, I'm sort of getting ahead of myself. When you add things like compost and fertilizer to your beds, you're feeding the soil biome. And all the different microorganisms and different, you know, little creatures in your soil, you know this, it breaks, you know, breaks things down, breaks whatever you're putting in there down and makes them available for your plants. So adding inputs to a closed system is not a bad thing, in my opinion. Does that make sense?
Definitely, because then that's how they're getting, the system is getting more nutrients is from you, especially if you're planting on a surface that it's not naturally getting more inputs from.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause how else would, you know, how else would they get nutrients? I don't know. I mean, you can let things decompose and stuff, but I don't know. That's a whole nother topic. But yeah, I would say if building an impervious surface, I would say be sure that your beds are deep. Be sure you're adding nutrients to the beds. And then if you're at all concerned about any sort of contaminants in the soil, I would definitely line the beds. And aesthetically, for aesthetic purposes, we always line beds that are on impervious surfaces, because there's no way for you to make the bottom of your bed perfectly flush. I mean, you could, but it would take months or years or whatever,
so
you know,
long.
Perfectly flush with whatever surface you're building on. So, you know, again, you're creating a container when you're creating a raised bed, and especially one that's on an impervious surface. And so you need to give that container a bottom. Otherwise your soil is going to come out, you know, come out the bottom. And it's, if you don't care aesthetically, then it's not the end of the world, but it can be a little bit of a safety issue, because that if it does come out the bottom, like if soil or water is coming out the bottom of your beds and your pathways get a little slippery, it can just be a little sketchy to move around. So I don't know, something I've noticed.
Yeah. And it seems like you could also lose some of your soil and have to keep adding more on top.
Totally.
And so if you have like your bed laid out on say cement or pavement or something, are you taking landscape fabric then and sort of folding it on the inside before you put any soil or ingredients down?
Exactly. Yeah. What we do is we line, like you'd have the frame, which is your just basic, you know, let's just call it, we'll say like your 4x8 foot frame. It could be any size, but we'll just say that. And it's seated, it's set down on your concrete. We'll use concrete as an example. Then yeah, you line the bed with landscape fabric and actually staple it to the inside of the bed. And then we go as far as taking like really thin pieces of wood and stapling that to the top of where the landscape fabric is. So it's kind of trimmed out and really like solid in there. And that's kind of going above and beyond, but it's not a bad thing to do. And then you would fill your beds with soil. And if you were doing irrigation, you would want to have your header or your main line run into the bed before you put the landscape fabric in. Otherwise, you'll find yourself unstapling it and creating a little spot for your tube to come up and into the bed, if that makes sense.
That's a pro tip right there. Save yourself a headache.
Yeah. Yeah. We definitely made that mistake. We don't want you to make it. We've made all the mistakes. So we're sharing pro tips.
I think that's a good part of gardening though, is that there's little mistakes, even with plants. I mean, I've been gardening for several years, but I still kill plants every year. And there's just always something that I'm learning. I feel like the garden teaches me a lot. So it's good. And so just last thing, I am really excited about growing. I just find the experience of like taking a tiny little seed and seeing it grow into this beautiful plant, just so rewarding and enjoyable. And so I was wondering, for people who might be getting started, or do you have any pro tips again for someone who's just getting into gardening that might help them sort of take the step from being really nervous about it to feeling like they can do it? Just an easy, you know, how should people get started, I guess?
Yes. Oh, this is my favorite topic. I think to get started, like I mentioned before, set yourself up for success. So be sure that you're choosing a good gardening environment, a good growing environment, whatever that looks like for what you're growing. Number two, I would say follow the rules. I know that sounds so lame.
No, it's true.
And like, I'm not a rule follower really, but I would say follow the rules. Look at the seed packet and, you know, read it and actually follow the rules. If it says plant a space, or if it says space a plant a foot apart, space the plant a foot apart, you know, like don't, just follow the rules and start there. And it sounds so lame, I know, but it's really going to, if you follow the rules and are successful, it's so empowering. And then you can start breaking rules. Not to just like plug our book, but if you're learning to grow vegetables, I would highly recommend our first book, which is Food Grown Right in Your Backyard. Because like I said, it kind of takes you through the different vegetable crops. And then if you're a flower gardener, there's a book. Well, I don't know. Again, I said there's like no book that's like the perfect beginner flower gardener, but
yes, I think that's so true though, that there's not a lot of books that sort of break it down for beginners. It's like kind of overwhelming when you open it. And I feel like that sometimes might hold people back from gardening, feeling like they have to achieve every single thing.
Well, that's just it. I was going to say, start small. That was my next tip, was just start small.
Yeah.
Because again, if you can start small and everything's super productive and feels manageable, then you're so much more empowered to then move forward and, you know, create something bigger and expand your growing space. But also starting small, you can learn, you know, you can really see what went wrong, what you were successful at, and then tweak and make changes. And if you do too much if you start with too much, I feel like it can be overwhelming. You can't really track, you know, your successes and your failures, or, you know, your learning moments. But I would say start small, follow the rules, and have fun. You know, don't be hard on yourself, because we all make mistakes and that's part of it. And you're working with plants, and plants are going to die.
Yes.
This is one of the things that Colin told me when I was first started working with him. He's like, well, plants die sometimes. You just have to replant it, you know? And like, that's true. If you have time, you know, if your plant died and you have time to replant it, try again. You know, because don't like be hard on yourself, and just remember the basics. You know, plants like sun, they like, you know, for the most part, plants like sun and water and some sort of, you know, some nutrients. So if you can provide that, then you're good to go.
And as a plant addict, I was just going to say that it's kind of funny, because I feel like I always grow more seeds than I can actually plant out. And so when something dies, it is such a bummer, but I'm like, well, I have 800 other things that are ready to go and I have nowhere to put them. So it's kind of an opportunity.
Yeah, totally. And I love that that's your perspective on that, because a lot of people would say, oh my God, I have 800 plants. Every single one of them needs to go into my garden. I actually usually say for beginning gardeners to, I like recommend that you don't start your own transplants. And that's because that's like this whole other, it's a commitment. You're like married to those little babies. You know, you have to make sure that they're taken care of and watered every day. And again, it's one of these things, if you don't like plant big, healthy transplants into the garden, they might not thrive. And then you're going to think that there's something wrong with you. But starting seeds is like a whole nother skill set, I feel like. So another thing, yeah, I recommend a lot is just like, don't be afraid to go to your local nursery and buy plants that need to be transplanted into the garden. And also familiarize yourself with the difference between transplanting and direct seeding. Currently, I'm trying to make a video describing those two techniques, and it feels like a big task. I'm like, oh my gosh, there's so many layers to this, but really it's simple. You know, some crops should be sown directly into the garden and some crops should be transplanted into the garden. So, you know, familiarizing yourself with those two techniques is also really helpful for a new gardener.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your tips and expertise and your knowledge with us. And where can people find you on the socials?
We are at Seattle Urban Farm Co. on pretty much everything, I think. So that should get you there. Our website's seattleurbanfarmco.com, and there's tons of blogs and just different resources there, including links to, you know, all of our socials and our books and all of that, and the podcast, which the podcast is called Encyclopedia Botanica. I went rogue and I gave it its own name because I felt like it. That has a lot of, I've interviewed quite a few flower growers or just had some flower focused podcasts on that.
Great. Well, we'll link to those episodes in the show notes and to your website and everything. So thank you so much for your time. And
of course.
And it was so good talking to you.
Thank you. It was so good talking to you too. I appreciate you having me on, and yeah, excited to listen to your podcast.
Yay. All right. Yay. Well, we'll talk to you soon. Take care, Hillary.
All right. Thank you. Bye.
I had so much fun recording with Hillary, and I hope we'll have her back in the future to keep talking about more gardening topics. Before we go today, I just wanted to leave you with a little bit of info. I'm going to try to close out these podcasts with what I'm going to call flower facts. Our flower friends, flower facts. So because it's daffodil season, we're in really high swing here at my home garden. We just have all different varieties of daffodils in bloom. And one thing that a lot of people may or may not already know is that daffodils emit this sap, and it can kind of make your hands itch or just be a little bit uncomfortable. So just from that perspective, you might want to avoid touching that sap directly, and then also avoid rubbing it in your eyes or anything like that. But in addition, other flowers don't like the daffodil sap. And so I like to recommend one of two things. You can either keep your daffodils on their own in a vase, just put them directly into cool water, or if you want to mix your daffodils with other flowers, harvest the daffodils on their own, put them in a vase on their own, like together only with daffodils, and let them sit for about 6 hours. Basically, just let them rest so that they can stop emitting the sap. They kind of heal themselves. They're still able to take up water, but if you just let them sit, they won't emit that sap that can kill other flowers. Then you can mix them with other flowers. The issue with that, though, is the heights, and I run into this a lot when I make arrangements. So I'll harvest more daffodils than I think that I'll need, and I cut each one to a height, different height, so that I have options when I go to arrange. So I'll have like 8 cups on my counter with like short, a little bit bigger, a little bit bigger, and basically I'll have like an array that I can choose from. And so I let all of those sit for about 6 hours. Most of the time I let them sit overnight because I really want to be sure when I'm delivering to a customer that I'm not sending along something that's really going to be a traitor and kill the other flowers within the arrangement. So I'll let those sit. And then when I go to arrange, I have lots of options to pick from that are the height I need, and I don't have to recut any of those stems. if you're mixing daffodils in a mixed bouquet that you might be sending home with a customer or that you just want on your countertop, a lot of people, to keep the vase life of their flowers, they love to go back in and snip the ends a few days later. And with most flowers, that does help extend the vase life. If they have a fresh cut, they can take up more water. But with daffodils, you don't want to do that. You don't want to recut because they'll start emitting the sap again and that will kill the other flowers. So I just want to mention this in case you have some daffodils blooming in your yard, in your neighbor's yard, that they want to share with you, that you can condition them on their own so that they're not harming other flowers that you might want to mix them with. Daffodils have a bad rep. A lot of people think of the bright yellow daffodils, but there are so many amazing kinds right now. If you go to my Grow Girl Seattle Instagram, you can see many of the ones that I'm growing in my garden. A lot of them are like cream. They might have like a soft yellow center. There's so many that have like fluttery petals that are really gorgeous. So I just wanted to mention that. Because I just think they smell amazing, they look amazing, and they just bring such a fresh, happy kind of element to different bouquets and arrangements. So I hope that will help with your daffodil harvesting, and come back to the end of the episodes for more flower facts. And the very last thing is, on the first episode of the podcast, the intro episode where my husband Vikram interviewed me just about my little flower business and how I got into this, I talked a lot about inspiration, and I forgot to mention that music is one of my greatest inspirations. I listen to podcasts a lot when I'm like processing flowers and, you know, doing things like putting vase mechanics in when I'm prepping. But when I'm actually designing, I almost never listen to a podcast. I only listen to music. And I just feel like there's something about music that just really helps me be creative and just gets me really happy. I don't know. There's some songs that I just like love to dance. And then I, you know, I'm like dancing around the kitchen and making something that I think is really beautiful. Or something that's really sad, and it just like helps me pour my mood into the arrangement that I'm doing. So I thought it would be fun at the end of the episode to recommend a song of the week. That's something that was just kind of inspiring to me, or a song that I love that you might like to listen to when you're playing with flowers, or just some song you forgot about that you want to add to a mix that you're making. So the song of the week is When You're Gone by the Cranberries, going with a classic. And I'm sure I'm going to regret this, make a total fool of myself, but because I can't afford to purchase the rights to these songs, I am going to sing you out as the outro music of Flower Friends. That's how much I love you guys. You are my flower friends. You deserve a great song, and I can't afford it. So here we go. Doobada, doobada, doobada. Okay, I didn't promise I was going to sing a lot, just a little bit to get you in the mood. It's like a preview. So anyway, hope you go listen to some Cranberries. Hope you do some stuff with flowers. Tag me in it so I can see what you're working on. I love flowers, and I'm just so excited to talk more about them with our amazing guests that are coming up. So the next episode, we're going to talk about sheet mulching with Janice Groves, Jay's Garden Journal on Instagram. Some of you might follow her. Can't wait to hear more from Jay, and so we'll post that next Monday. All right, talk to you guys later.